English audio on Kabad.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad of South London, England.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the history series. Moving into a very fascinating period of Jewish history, let me just go over very, very briefly the time scales that we're talking about. The Churban Bayis Sheni, the second temple, was destroyed in the year 68 of the Common Era. The Mishnah, of which we talked about last week, the first time the oral tradition was put into writing, was done in the year 218 of the Common Era, and the height of Babylonian Jewry was in the year 500 of the Common Era, when the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, was finally edited. The great period of Babylonian Jewry was from the year 500 CE until its close in the year 1038. And this is the period of history that we focused on last week, the Babylonian era of the yeshivas of Mesopotamia, the Tanoim, Amoraim, the Gaonim, the Rabbonon Savaroi. These were the people we discussed last week. And what I'm going to do this week is to have a look at what happened in exactly the same period, but in a different area of the world. In general, historians split up the history of the last two millennia in the following manner. They say that from the years 500 to 1500 of the Common Era are called the Middle Ages. Why are they called the Middle Ages? They're called that because before the year 500 and after the year 1500, there was a classical age. The Greeks and Romans, till certain points of the Roman Empire, but certainly the Greeks, Hellenism and so on and so forth, we could have said it was an age of great antiquity and great classics. After the year 1500, there was a Renaissance and a classical revival. However, between those two points, in the Middle Ages, in general, it was, in the non-Jewish world, a time of moral decadence and, in general, ignorance of the masses. Particularly in the first period, which we're going to discuss this evening, from the year 500 to the year 1000 of the Common Era. In the Middle Ages itself, those are called the Dark Ages. And they were called the Dark Ages because of the lack of culture. And what is fascinating is that it is particularly at this time, in the time of what, as world history notes, were the Dark Ages, that we have a tremendous flourishing of Jewish learning and culture. Last week we had a look at the Babylonian scene. And this evening we're going to look at the similar period, what was happening with the Jews in Europe between the years 500 and 1000, or thereabouts. And please God, next week we will move on and have a look at some of the great personalities and figures, such as Maimonides and Rashi, and great other commentators that rose up. But little is known of Jewish history of the Dark Ages. And what we're going to do is, although it's entitled this evening, The Jews of Spain, we're going to have a quick glance at Italy first. And the reason we're going to Italy is because, of course, Rome is in Italy. It was the Romans who destroyed the temple, and we'll soon find that the earliest Jews who came to Europe came via Rome. And then we're going to have a look at Gaul, otherwise known as France. And then we will get on to having a look at what was happening to the Jews of Spain. So let's start this evening with Italy. After the conquest of the land of Israel by the legions of Pompey, a large number of Jews emigrated to Rome. The community of Rome was greatly influenced by Jews who came to Rome to settle and also to have an influence in the Roman Senate. The Jews themselves, for the betterment of the Jews in the land of Israel, needed to have, if you want, a Jewish lobby in the Senate of Rome, and a community sprung up. It's rather similar to, Jewish lobby in America at the moment, in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, which you have got a large number of Jewish statesmen who try and put their tuppence halfpenny worth in Washington. The community didn't just focus only in Rome, but it spread north as well to Milan, Genoa, and also Sicily. In fact, prior to the control of Christianity of the area, Jews were very much tolerated and Jewish settlement was encouraged. It was, however, in the 4th century when Rome embraced Christianity and made it its religion. It was then that persecution very much characterized the treatment of the Jews in Italy. And towards the end of the 5th century, the Roman Empire started to crumble, and it was taken over by a number of barbaric Germanic tribes. In fact, 6 tribes were involved, and I couldn't remember all their names, so I'll have to read it out for you. I just love reading these names. They are so they conjure up such great ideas of who these people were. Who was the great? I often, when I was reading this, I was thinking of the great comic, the Gaul comic. What's it called? Asterix. Yeah, I'm sure they didn't look anything like Asterix the Gaul, but just to hear where they were coming from sounds like that. Western Europe was divided among 6 major Germanic tribes. The Ostrogoths came to Italy. The Visigoths in Spain and southwestern Gaul. The Burgundians in southeastern Gaul, which came to be known as Burgundy. The Anglo-Saxons, yay, in England. The Franks in France and what is now Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And the Vandals, whose main kingdom was in North Africa. Okay? In fact, the Vandals initially crossed the Rhine into Gaul, going across the Pyrenees all the way through Spain to North Africa, which is where they settled. I learned something new from the word vandal. I always wondered, where does the word vandal come from? And vandalization, apart from having one's mirror ripped off the car and so on and so forth. However, the source of the word vandals and vandalization, in fact, comes from this nation, because it was a Vandal ruler called Gaiseric who built a navy in the year 455 CE and led a fleet across the Mediterranean to Rome and sacked the city and absolutely vandalized Rome. That's where we get it. That's why it's called a Vandal. The sack of Rome. And they carried away many of the Kli Kodesh, many of the holy objects of the temple from Rome. Now, if I may digress for a moment, it's an interesting question as where did the artifacts of the temple end up? The Talmud attests to the fact that the Ark of Covenant, in which the tablets of stone and the Sefer Torah, which Moses wrote, this was entombed in catacombs under the Temple Mount before the destruction of the first temple. And in fact, in the time of the second temple, in the Holy of Holies, there was no ark. Unlike the first temple, where the entire duration of the first temple, the holy ark was placed inside the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem, inside the temple. In the second temple, it was just an empty room. All that was there was the Evan Shasir, the great foundation stone, the famous stone which supposedly is the stone today under the Al-Akbar Mosque. That was the only artifact inside the Holy of Holies in the Second Temple times. However, we do see pictorial depictions of the artifacts of the temple on the Arch of Titus in Rome. We do see there, in fact, a menorah which is, has round branches. This has, of course, raised the question as to that if that was the actual menorah which was in the temple, because it's the opinion of Maimonides and many other commentaries that the menorah which was in the temple had branches which went out as a triangle, if you want, from the main stem. They went out as diagonals, straight, rather as being curved. Although there are in fact many menorahs in the temple, although supposedly the one which was in the inner precinct was one which the branches went out as a diagonal. Whichever is the case, no doubt many of the temple vessels ended up certainly in Rome. And we're told that the Vandals sacked Rome and stole many of these artifacts, and therefore any artifact which may be outside of Rome certainly could be attributed to their Geneva. Now the question is, where do they in fact end up? So the idea of having an ark, so to speak, in Ethiopia is certainly not not the Jewish belief. However, there was a rumor, how can I say, that went around that the Choshen Mishpat, the breastplate of the high priest, was in the British Museum in London. Of course, that proved to be false, or at least so the curator said. but there was a whole, I can't surmise, a whole story, and of course these are still being tracked today. These are priceless items held presumably somewhere in somebody's vault in the Rome, although it is still believed that many of these items found their way back to Rome, of course, because when the Bishop of Rome eventually became the Pope, and Christianity was embraced by the vast majority of Europe, it is most probable that a lot of these artifacts did make their way back to Rome, and it would be wonderful if the Jews today would be able to have an accurate content, what's it called, an inventory of exactly what is in the Vatican vaults. I think if they did that, I think a bigger hue and cry than they're getting back all the money in Switzerland, we start going to the Vatican and saying pay up. This of course reminds me of a story which I don't think I mentioned when we were studying the period of Alexander the Great. In the times of Alexander the Great, there was a delegation who came from Egypt and said to Alexander that it's not fair. The Jews, when they came out of Egypt, they ransacked Egypt. As we're told in this week's Sedra, they absolutely took all the vessels and silver and gold of Egypt, and the Egyptians said, well, we want it back. So Alexander sent a delegation to the Jews that they must give a coherent answer. If not, then they're right. So the Jews were in a quandary what to do, until a hunchback called Gviha ben Pasisa came along. He said, I'll go and give an answer. And he said, either way, if the answer I give will be accepted, very good. And if not, well, then you'll tell Alexander, oh, that was what a hunchback said. He's not a good representative of the people. We'll send you a proper person. So they send Gvir Pemsisa, and he did, in fact, give a good argument back. He said to Alexander, what, these Egyptians are asking for all their silver and gold back. He said, okay, before we give it back, I need to make another calculation. Let's calculate the wages of 600,000 people for 210 years. Because at the end of the day, the Jews number 600,000 people, and we work for the Egyptians for 210 years for free. He said, let's make the calculation, and you'll see that in fact the wages comes out much more than all the silver and gold in Egypt. So Alexander said to the Egyptians, what do you say? And they didn't have anything more to say, and Gavir ben Pasisa was saying. So I was vindicated. So I think today if we made that calculation of in fact how much the Christian world has plundered from the Jewish communities all through the Middle Ages, and of course systematically destroyed. We talk about the Holocaust. The Holocaust was just quite simple, a transfer of bank accounts. At the end of the day, they just took artifacts, gold and silver and money, from a very brief, in a very brief period. In over the Middle Ages, community after community was plundered. All this money, where was it taken? Much of it, and I'm sure a lot of the artifacts ended up in the church's coffers, and probably funded many churches. If we were in fact to take an inventory or know exactly how much is that, I'm sure it would add up to a pretty penny. So who knows what is in the Vatican vaults today? We do not know. Let's get back to the period of history which we're talking about. The Vandals had ransacked Rome, and in the year 476 of the Common Era, a king called Odoacer, that's the correct pronunciation of his name, he was a king of the barbarians in Italy. He deposed Emperor Romulus Augustus, bringing an end to the Western Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire was collapsing, and basically it collapsed into two parts. The Western Roman Empire was taken over, as I said beforehand, by these six Germanic tribes. The Eastern Roman Empire became the Byzantine Empire. Now, from the years 489 of the Common Era to 563, there was a very bitter power struggle between the Ostrogoths, who we mentioned beforehand, and this is a new word which I learned, who were Arians. What is the word? Where does the word Arian come from? The Arians were a sect of Christians who originated by a man called Arius of Alexandria, who in the 4th century, his religious views differed very much from those of what would become the Catholic views. And he became an Arian. Now, in fact, the Catholics viewed the Arians as pagans, although they were actually also part of the Christian broader church. There was a bitter power struggle between these Ostrogoths and the Byzantines. And what was happening in Europe at the time, if you want the Western Empire of Rome and the Eastern Empire of Rome, of the Roman Empire, may it rest in peace, that Roman Empire which was now gone, but the Eastern and Western parts of it were constantly vying and having a tremendous power struggle. In general, the Ostrogoths tolerated the Jews. The Byzantines persecuted tremendously the Jews. And therefore, who did the Jews stick up for? The Ostrogoths. Well, that was okay if they were in control. But if the Byzantines got in control, then they mercilessly persecuted the Jews. So decades of war saw land change many times. I think a similar period in history must be in the times of Austria, Hungary, and also Hungarian War, where the borders of Austria, Hungary, Poland, Russia were constantly changing, and who got the worst of it all? The Jews, because whoever they supported, they were the losers. There was in fact one particular occasion in the town of Naples where the Jews were such valiant supporters of the Ostrogoths that they orchestrated the entire defense of the city of Naples against the Byzantines. And they would have succeeded had it not been for the treachery of the local residents, who in fact preferred the Byzantines. The Byzantines themselves were overcome in the year 568 by an invasion of people called the Lombards. And whilst that was all happening, there was a change of the seat of religious power in the Christian Rome, in the Christian world, which, as I said before, now became very much focused on the Bishop of Rome, otherwise nowadays known as the Pope. And he became, or started to become, the preeminent figure in the Catholic world. And much of this was done to a Pope called Gregory the Great. He lived in the year 590 to the year 604. And of course, Gregory introduced much of what we call the Gregorian calendar, and so on and so forth. He introduced many reforms into and rules into the church. He was opposed, Gregory was opposed to forced conversions. But short of that, did everything he possibly could to proselytize Jews. In other words, to nail them to the cross, he didn't. But short of that, he did everything. So, for example, the Jew was told, look, you want to be Jewish? You can be Jewish. We're not going to force you to become a Christian. But you can't breathe, you can't eat, you can't sleep, you can't whatever, if you don't become a Christian. The taxation was unbelievable, and there was tax relief if you converted. Could you imagine? Talk about Jewish being good tax evaders. the tax evasion was our forte, and always has been. And yet, in this era, nobody wished to evade that tax. Because although that tax relief was put there, if you became a Christian, very few Jews chose that path. Let's move over from Italy to Gaul, to France. As the Roman Empire expanded, as we said beforehand, the Jewish communities went from Rome to Milan, moving further north, they also brought in Jewish settlements into Gaul. And again, the Jews were very much tolerated in Gaul until the Christian fanaticism of the year 500 and thereabouts, when Christianity had sort of consolidated its grip in the area, and it really climaxed in Gaul, the persecution, in the year 629, when a king called Dagobert decreed the expulsion or the conversion from Jews in Gaul. So he gave them a choice. You either convert or you get out. And believe it or not, from the year 629, for more than 100 years, Gaul was Judenfrei. There were no Jews living in Gaul. He kept the Jews out. Terrible word to use that, but there we had it. It was Jew-free. There was, however, a period of grace. In the year 768 to the year 814 of the Common Era, of Charlemagne. Charlemagne was very tolerant to the Jews, so was his son, who was called Louis the Pious. He was very tolerant, and also he allowed and invited scholars to come into the land, and under his reign, yeshivas were set up in Mayence, although that's, I suppose, bordering on Germany, isn't it? And Narbonne, which is the south of France, and the south of France, the yeshivas were established in his period, and the Jews had were let back in, and there was somewhat of a renaissance of Judaism in Gaul. So that's what was going on in France. Had a look at Italy. This evening, however, most importantly, we want to discuss what was going on in Spain. Because it was at this period, and in this period, that the Jews had an unbelievable golden era in Spain. Again, the original Jews who arrived in Spain arrived with the expansion of the Roman Empire. And again, initially they were tremendously persecuted when Christianity took its hold on the Roman Empire. In fact, if you've ever been to Mallorca or Menorca for holiday, you should know that the Bishop of Menorca in fact exterminated all the Jews on those two islands during this era. So one should know that in fact these two islands were islands where there was a tremendous anti-Semitism. In the year 412, the Visigoths came and conquered Spain and took it away from the Roman Empire, as the Roman Empire was crumbling anyway. Now the Visigoths were related to the Ostrogoths, and as I explained beforehand, they were viewed as pagans by the Catholics. So of course, who became the Visigoths' best friends? The Jews. They were their natural allies against the Catholics. And at that time, from the year 412, the Jews enjoyed more than a century of peace and prosperity under the Visigoths in Spain. It was only later on in the year 586 that a king called I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, I think it's Ricared, R-E-C-C-A-R-E-D, Ricared. He was surrounded by Catholic ministers, and they managed to get him to proclaim Catholicism as the state religion. And thereafter, after a 100-year grand period in Spain, followed a period of merciless persecution, followed by heavy taxation and all sorts of decrees. The Jews were only relieved from that persecution when, in the year 711, the Berbers, who were a North African tribe, crossed into Spain. There's another thing I learned over here. Their leader, the leader of the Berbers, was a man called Tariq ibn Zayd. And in fact, the word Gibraltar, the word, you think of that, the word Gibraltar means the rock of Tariq. So this guy, Tariq ibn Zayd, had this rock of Gibraltar named after him. And of course, it's interesting to know that even today, of all places, Gibraltar has a very vibrant Jewish community. It's a little rock over there in Spain, although Spain itself today is virtually, I mean, you have a Chabad shliach in Madrid and there's another one in Barcelona, but it compared to what it was and what it is today, and yet Gibraltar remains today quite a very involved Jewish community. Gibraltaric. After the Tariq. They don't say Gibraltar. The people in Spain call it?
The Arabs
call it. The Arabs. Now, this Arab conquest in 711 ushered in one of the most tranquil and productive periods of Jewish life in Spain. For 200 years, there were constant rivalries between different chieftains. In fact, either the Arabs were fighting in between themselves, and even when they weren't fighting in between themselves, they were fighting their neighbors. Having said all that, the Jews lived relatively calmly. In 732, Charlemagne, who was tolerant to the Jews from France, defeated the Arabs decisively at the battle called Poitiers, and the Arabs withdrew to Spain and consolidated. So Charlemagne at that time was tolerant to the Jews in France, but the Arabs, the Moors, who had gone to expand their empire, they now came back rather defeated, but they consolidated in Spain, and although they taxed the Jews highly in order to finance their campaigns, in general they left them alone and allowed them to develop culturally, which of course was very, very important for the growth of these Jewish communities, and as we'll soon meet, some of the great people who flourished in them. Originally, this Arab rule, we said that the Berbers came over, originally they were controlled by Damascus. However, in the year 556, a king called Abdurrahman, he proclaimed himself king in Cordoba, in Spain, and he proclaimed himself independent from any other foreign Arab control. He was a great enlightened king, and he developed Cordoba tremendously and treated the Jews very well. Spain rose to be a great center of art and culture. He built beautiful palaces, this Abdurrahman. An example of how great the Jews rose in his days was in the body and the figure of a Jew called Chastai ben Yitzchak ibn Shaprut. Now, just simply, I think we can call him Chastai. He lived in the year 915 to the year 970. Originally, he had a yeshiva education and then trained to be a physician. He was so good, he was appointed to become the physician of the caliphate, of the caliph. often, in fact, the caliph used to take a Jewish doctor. It was quite. It happened also in the times of the Ramah. The Jews were quite good doctors. He was such a good doctor, he rose to becoming his chief advisor. Not only his chief advisor, he appointed him as his foreign minister, and in fact as the head of the treasury. And Chastai did a tremendous job for the caliph at the time in foreign affairs and diplomacy, sorting out. In fact, he fended off many an attacker on Spain. Those even those who had more powerful armies. One of Chastai's great students was a man called Dunash Halevi Ben Labrat, and this era, in fact, in Spain, came to be known as a great poetic era for the Jews. Many of our great piyutim, now a piyut is a poem written by a piyot who is a poet. Okay, I just said that. That sounds good. That rhymes. Much of the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and many of our high holy days and festivals were written by people who lived in this era. Some of our Zemirot of Shabbos come from this. Do you know a song called Derar Yikra? Derar Yikra Levenim Bas. This is an acrostic. An acrostic means that every sentence begins with the letter that begins with a sentence spells out the name of the person. So Derar Yikra actually starts with a Dalet, and then the next sentence starts with a Vav, the next sentence starts with a Nun, and then the final sentence with a Shin. It reads Dunash. Dunash Halevi Ben Labrat was a student of Chastai. He wrote many of the Zemirot. Chastai was instrumental, because of his great position as foreign minister to the caliph, he was instrumental in transferring the seat of Torah Jewry from Babylon to Spain. And in fact, the stepping stone was, as we discussed last week, Cairo 1 in Tunisia, but many sages started flowing from Babylon to the west and ended up in Spain. He established a yeshiva. He corresponded with the Gaonim, with the great leaders of Babylon, and in fact they conferred upon him the Chastai, the title of Reish Kala, if you want, the head of the head of the Kala. The Kala was the time when twice a year in the months of the Kala Jews would stop working and gather around their spiritual teachers in order to be enlightened, in order to be taught. It was rather like an extended bank holiday weekend down here, where we'd go to some resort for a Limud conference, or to whatever you go, just to be imbued with learning. And he was given this title of Reish Kala. I suppose today it would be equivalent of being given an honorary doctorate of a university. Now there's a beautiful story over here. Four great Jews on a ship were shipwrecked. Well, that's not exactly how it happened. What happened was, there were four great Jews on a ship, and the admiral of Abdurrahman pirated this ship. He stopped it in the high oceans, and he took all the people, as was custom then, and sold them as slaves. However, he didn't realize that on this ship were four great Jewish scholars. In other words, by divine providence, the admiral of Abdurrahman intercepted in the Mediterranean a ship which happened to be carrying four great scholars, and sold each one of them as slaves. One of them was called Reb Shemaria. These were all four great scholars of the Babylonian school. One of them was called Shemaria, was sold to the Jewish community in Alexandria, and there he established the yeshiva. Another one called Reb Chushiel was sold to the Jewish community in Cairo 1, and there he established the yeshiva. The other two, one called Reb Moshe ben Chanoich and his son Chanoich, were sold to the Jewish community in Cordova, and there they established the yeshiva. So in fact, although these four rabbis who were on a voyage, they originated from Babylon, they were sold to three communities where each one of them established a big yeshiva, and in fact these became, if you want, the spiritual stepping stones for the transfer of the Torah in Babylon to Western Europe. There's a beautiful story of how this Reb Moshe ben Chanoich arrived in Cordova. He was, you can imagine, the admiral, the captain of the ship, coming into Cordova with a whole bunch of slaves for sale, and of course between them are some Jews, and he goes over to the Jewish community and he says, listen, I've got a whole bunch of Jews over here, do you want to buy them? Now there's no greater mitzvah than pidyon shvuyim, than redeeming captives. So they bought them, and they bought these ragged survivors into the shul. It just so happens that at that time in the shul, the dayan of the community of Cordoba, a man called Rabbi Nosson, was giving a drasha. He was giving a discourse. And as he was giving this discourse, this Reb Moshe, who had been one of the captives, made a comment from the back of the room, and he said, well, what do you mean by that? Like, he was a ragged wretch from the back of the room, and they started having a discourse between them, and it just so happened that this Reb Moshe was vastly superior in knowledge to Reb Nosson, and Reb Nosson there and then stepped down from his position and said, and he insisted that this Reb Moshe, who had just come off their ship, be appointed as the Rosh Hashiva, as the head and the chief dayan in Cordova. Chastai, who we said beforehand was the prime minister, well, he was the foreign minister of the king, agreed, and a tremendous yeshiva was built in Cordova. In fact, it can be said that it was on the equivalent level in learning and scholarship and piety as the Babylonian yeshiva. Another one of the great people who contributed a tremendous amount to our liturgy and grammar was a man called Menachem ben Surup. He lived in the year 910 to 970. He wrote many poems and a dictionary, one of the very first Jewish dictionaries. In fact, if you have a look in Rashi's commentary on the Torah, often Rashi will say, Menachem Pirush, Menachem explains, and he's referring to Menachem ben Surup, who lived in Spain, who was one of the great grammarians of that era, and of course language really took off in Spain. In other words, the Jewish people in Spain invested a tremendous amount into the into style, really, of the of Hebrew grammar and language, and more than perhaps their, or perhaps not more, but in addition to their huge contribution to commentary on the Talmud, they also made this tremendous contribution of liturgy, much of which, as I said before, is incorporated in our Machzorim and Sidurim. Another interesting story which happened at the time of Chastai, including after this, in addition to this, these four rabbis on a ship, another very, very interesting story which happened in his time was the following. There was a great Jewish traveller who lived at the times of Chastai in Spain. I suppose he was like the Jewish Marco Polo. And his name was Eldad Hadani. Eldad Hadani. Now this Eldad Hadani went on lots of Jewish travels all around the world, and he came back and reported to Chastai that a Jewish community existed in southeastern Russia between the Caspian and the Black Seas, and it was called the Kingdom of the Khazars. Its king was a king called King Joseph. Its capital was in a place called Itil, which was on the mouth of the Volga River. Now this fascinated Chastai. He thought that this kingdom was in fact a kingdom of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And he was desperate to know whether they had any information on the coming of Mashiach, because it was believed that Mashiach would come when the 10 lost tribes would come back to the land of Israel. He sent a letter. How he tried to get it, don't ask. He tried numerous times with him, trying to communicate with him. But finally he sent a letter, he got a letter through to this King Joseph, the king of the Khazars, describing the plight of the Jews in exile, and of course of his great yearning for the redemption, and asking them if they knew anything of the coming of the Mashiach. He asked them if they were the 10 lost tribes. Several years later, a letter came back from the king of the Khazars saying the following, that this kingdom was not of Jewish origin, they were originally Turks. However, their original king, a king called King Bulan, embraced Judaism with the majority of his people. They converted to Judaism, and the way they did that was is that he orchestrated a great debate between a Jewish rabbi, a Christian priest, and a Islamic, whatever he's called, and what? A mullah. And the Jewish rabbi won the debate, and as a result of that, Bulan himself converted to Judaism and converted many of his people to Judaism. Now, Chastai's letter to the king of the Khazars and the reply of the king of the Khazars back to Chastai, we have. And those two very, very important historical documents are printed in a book called Kuzari, which was written by a man called Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which about whom we'll discuss next week. Okay? But it's fascinating to think of the globalization of the Jews at that time, where there was very little communication, of how one letter was sent and one letter was received. But we have those both ideas of two Jewish communities, one in, some people say it was in the Crimea, or thereabouts, and one in Spain, of how they wanted to find out what was going on. And in fact, Chastai himself of Spain was offered the position to go to the kingdom of the Khazars and to be its king. In fact, the kingdom of the Khazars was so enthralled by having this communication, hearing what such a great person was, although he never actually made it. Eventually, the kingdom of the Khazars was destroyed by the Tatars in a short time after that. We don't know what happened to them. Presumably, they were absorbed into mainstream Russia and either lost, or perhaps some of us are their descendants, who knows. With the rise of learning in Spain, there was, as I said before, a great focus on the Hebrew language, its grammar, philology and lexicography, poetry and prose, both religious and secular. Much of it was written in Arabic, which was the spoken language of the time, and in fact, many rabbis composed many of their great works in Arabic, only having later great translators translating them into Hebrew. In the year 1012, so let's summarize perhaps the Dark Ages in Spain, we can say that there was a golden era, the first golden era of the Spanish era in Spain, in fact the Dark Ages. But in the year 1012, the fortune of the Jews changed. The tolerant caliphs of Cordoba were conquered by a Berber called Suleiman, and most of the Jewish homes in Cordoba were looted, and the Jews were forced to flee from Cordoba, and they ran to three towns mainly, the town of Granada, Toledo, and Saragossa. So in fact, in 1012, Cordoba was decimated by Suleiman, but we will come back later to Cordoba. Let's, however, move on to a very influential figure in the Jewish world at that time, another one. Among those Jews who were forced to flee from Cordova was a Jew called Shmuel Halevi ben Yosef ibn Nagdila. That's a long name. However, in short, he became known as Shmuel Hanogid, if you want, the Prince Shmuel. What was his story? He was born in Cordova in the year 993. He studied in the yeshiva of Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe, as we said before, was one of these ship fugitives. He studied in his yeshiva. He studied all classic languages, and eventually, because he had to run away from Cordova, settled in Malaga. Or Malaga. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Malaga.
He opened a spice store selling spices, which was a nice idea to do, and he had a good business. And his shop was near the palace of the royal vizier. The royal vizier was like the prime minister to the king. Now, when this royal vizier went on official state visits outside of Malaga, he asked that members of his household write to him to tell him about the affairs of what was going on in Malaga. However, none of them was particularly good at writing, but one thing they did know is that the Jew down at the spice store was very good at it. And they went down to the spice store and asked him, would he mind writing letters to the royal vizier to tell him, you know, give him the Reuters IPN what's going on. So, this is what Shmuel did. He was employed to write these letters in the royal vizier's absence. And when the royal vizier got a hold of these letters, he saw an extraordinary handwriting. And a style of handwriting which was quite amazing. He'd never seen anything like it beforehand. And when he got back to town, he employed this Shmuel as his private secretary. He was such a good secretary, he then employed him to become his advisor. And not only his advisor, but literally his right-hand man. In fact, when this royal vizier died, he said to the king that if the king would be smart, he would appoint Shmuel HaNogid as him, the prime minister to the king, who was called King Habus, who was king of the Berbers and ruler of Granada. And for 30 years, Shmuel HaNogid administered all the affairs of Granada and built it to becoming one of the most influential kingdoms in Spain. So we see how great, in fact, a Jew rose to becoming, if you want, almost the king, the Mishnah Lemez, the viceroy to the king, rather like Joseph in Pharaoh's times. He was a great Talmud Chacham, and in addition to being a great writer, he was also a great sage. He himself headed a yeshiva and, most important, employed scribes to copy the Talmud. Now, this was very important. How come that we do have the Talmud nowadays? After all, it was a book which was written in Babylon. It was because wealthy Jews saw to it to pay scribes to sit and copy over and over these texts, and then to send them around to all various communities. And today, in fact, although the world has changed so rapidly, but the very fact that we have today so many of the early manuscripts is very much due to these wealthy Jews who had the foresight to pay these scribes to do that copying. Shmuel HaNogid had great connections with another great Jew called Rabbeinu Nissim in Kairouan. And in fact, Shmuel HaNogid's son married Rabbeinu Nissim's daughter. It was what we call a Welt Shidduch, a world Shidduch, in that the leader of Jewry in Granada married his son, married the leader of Jewry in Kairouan's daughter, a big shidduch across the Mediterranean. I'm not sure where they made the chasna, where they made the chuppah, but this was big news. One of Shmuel HaNogid's famous students was a man called Reb Shlomo Ibn Gvirol. You may have, if you haven't heard of Shlomo Ibn Gvirol, you probably will have walked down Ibn Gvirol Street, or Anna Ibn Gvirol Street in Israel. We'll come back to him in a minute. Shmuel Hanogid wrote down many books. He wrote a beautiful introduction to the Talmud. Now, if you have a look in the Talmud tractate Brachos, which we do have, part of his introduction is still with us. Unfortunately, much of his writings is extinct. They were just lost. But part of his introduction to the Talmud we still have, and still today is considered one of the best introductions to the Talmud, surpassing even that of Steinsaltz and so on and so forth. But if you read it in its original, it's terrific. Shmuel Hanogid wrote a terrific introduction to the Talmud. And really, he played, following Chastai, Shmuel Hanogid played this huge part in bringing a very, very high level of culture, both as a patron and a participant. And I think this was perhaps part of his greatness. You've had Jews over the centuries who were either patrons or participants. Either they paid for it or they did it. But to have one who both paid for it and did it, this is why he was given the title Nogid. Nogid being the prince, in that he embraced both these qualities. He died in the year 1056 at the age of 64. Of course, what happened in 1056? 1066 was the Battle of Hastings. Well, 1056, Shmuel Hanogid died. It was 10 years before the Battle of Hastings. Now, a bit of tragedy for you. Shmuel Hanogid, his name was Shmuel Halevi ben Yosef. He had a son who he named after his father. He was called Yosef ibn Magdila. As great as the growth of the father was, so too was the demise of the son. The son of Shmuel Hanogid, of course, was given a tremendous education, was brought up in Granada. His father was the tops. His father was the one of the greatest Jews. He was the ruler almost of the entire Granada. He was brought up in a palace. He was given tremendous teachers, and he was a great scholar. He was also, however, conceited. And although when his father died, he was appointed as the new royal vizier, however, his love for ostentation aroused the jealousy of the Moorish populace in Granada, and his opponents accused him of conspiracy to overthrow the king. And because of that conspiracy and this accusation, a huge crowd of Moors stormed the royal palace. They found Yosef, the son of Shmuel Hanogid, in the cellar with a blackened face. He blackened his face in order to try and escape somewhere. And unfortunately, they nailed him to a cross. And they massacred some 1,500 families in the town of Granada. And that was the first of, unfortunately, the great massacres of Jews that took place on Spanish soil. Only a few escaped to tell the story, one of them in fact being his wife, the daughter of Rabbeinu Nissim, who in fact escaped. But what was tragic about this father and son was that as great as the father was over and ruled for 30 years, unfortunately, due to the conceit of the son, he had this tremendous downfall. I did mention to you that one of the great students of Shmuel Hanogid was Reb Shlomo Ibn Gvirol. As a boy, he was orphaned in Malaga, and he wandered literally by foot over to Granada and was adopted by Shmuel Hanogid. Very much a great part of the works of Reb Shlomo Ibn Gvirol were written in the house of Shmuel Hanogid, often tainted by a deep sorrow and melancholy over his bereavement as a child, his orphaned youth, and although, you know, he did have this sad streak in him, the poems which Shlomo Ibn Gvirol which he created, many of which whose theme was the return to Zion and that of redemption, were brilliant and almost unbeatable in their poetic form, their grace and their diction. To be an example, he for example took the 613 commandments and wrote them out in poetic form. Okay, I mean, even to enumerate them is some big deal. By the way, let me just digress for one moment, an important digression, and tell you the following. The Talmud tells us there are 613 commandments, tariag mitzvot, 365 negative commandments, 248 positive commandments. Now, when you read through the Chumash, you actually don't number them, or they are not numbered. Moses doesn't tell us, okay, mitzvah number one, boys, here, let's go. It doesn't do that for you. You're just told, do this, do that, do the other, and so on and so forth. And the Talmud tells us that we have a tradition that there are 630. However, it was only in this era that a number of Jews enumerated them. One of them was Rabbeinu Sadia Goin, who lived in Babylon. He lived before Maimonides' house. Sadia Goin. Another one was done by a man called Chinuch. Maimonides enumerated them and called it the Sefer HaMitzvahs. The Sefer HaMitzvahs, the Book of the Mitzvahs, which he enumerated the 613 commandments. Rav Shlomo Ibn Gvirol enumerated them but put them into poetic form. And the truth is, if you read through it, the Hebrew is so rich, and it's a wonderful thing to think that they were writing and they were so well versed in a language which really was not the language of the time. It wasn't the flavour of the day. Arabic was the spoken language, and yet these people knew that if they needed to secure the survival of the Jewish people, it would be through the common language of people. He wrote about himself. Shlomo Ibn Gvirol wrote about himself, I am the prince of all singers and master of the rhyme, I am the harp of the singing poets. A beautiful thing to say about himself. Unfortunately, he wrote a number of other works. He died a very premature death, in fact, the Shlomo Ibn Gvirol, at the hands of a very jealous Moor, who, upon seeing such a brilliant writer, was so jealous of him, killed him and buried him under a tree, which the tradition goes started producing unbelievably beautiful fruits. And he tasted these fruits. These fruits were very, very delicious, and the Moor brought the fruit to the king and told him what he'd done. He'd killed the Jew, and the tree had produced beautiful fruits, and taste one. He wanted to show the king how nice they were, and to say thank you. Of course, the king had him killed, because he realized how great the person obviously had been whom he'd killed. One final person we're going to talk about just before we close, because next week we are really going to talk about the very powerful greats, those of Rashi and Rambam. But one person who did his duty was a man called Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pekuda, otherwise known simply as Rabbeinu Bachya. He was a dayan in the town of Saragossa, and he wrote a major Jewish work, and he called it Chovos Halavavos, the duties of the heart. Now, in fact, even today, this book remains as one of the classics of Judaism. Why did he call it Chovos Halavavos? He said because the mitzvahs, the commandments, can be split into two. Chovos Ha'evarim, the duties of the limbs, in other words, those mitzvahs which you do physically, and Chovos Halavavos, duties of the heart. The love of God, the fear of God, the unity of God, and so on and so forth. Bitochin, trust in God, emunah, faith. And this work, although again originally written in Arabic, only later translated into Hebrew by a man called Yehuda ibn Tibbon. I like saying that. He was good at Yehuda ibn Tibbon. He was a great translator of Arabic works into Hebrew. This Rabbeinu Bechaya ibn Pakuda, he produced this Duties of the Heart. And if you ask anybody today who studied Jewish works of philosophy and ethical Jewish works, then the book Chovos Halavavos is one of the main works. In fact, today it's printed in English and accessible to all. So to summarize, we could perhaps summarize the Dark Ages of 500 year period between what was going on in Gaul, Italy, Spain, was the following. You had the breaking up of the Roman Empire. Towards the end of the Roman Empire, when it had embraced Christianity, persecution of the Jews where they lived. You had then different tribes taking over, who battled with each other. Of course, the Jews always getting the worst end of it. And you had the rise of the golden era of Spain, in which was under Arab Moor control, and number of personalities such as Chastai, Ibn Shaput, and Shmuel Hanogid rose, of course, due to this four men on a boat, growth of yeshivas, and in general the decline of the Babylonian community and the growth of Spanish community. And next week in Rosh Hashem we'll move on to looking at the great personalities who developed those even further, and then we start moving, if you want, further into Europe, back into France, Germany, and then into Eastern Europe. What is fascinating in this era is that although they were the Dark Ages, not very classical as far as the secular world was concerned, we could perhaps apply the verse in the book of Exodus, Kasha Ya'anu Osoi Ken Yirba V'Chen Yifrits, as they were afflicted, so too did they multiply and spread out forth. We find in this era that although the Jews, particularly under the Christians, were hounded from town to town, often heavily taxed, all forms of horrible decrees placed upon them, one would have thought that, as it says in the Bible, the dove didn't find a place to rest its feet. One would have thought that it would have fizzled out. One would have thought it would never have survived. Let alone produce great people, let alone produce scholarship, piety, and let alone produce excellence in a language unknown and uncommon to the people of that era, and let alone produce works which for time immemorial would stand out as great works. Often written in times of persecution, often written in running away, often written in so on and so forth. So I think that to put everything into perspective, we have to see each era and period in Jewish history as somewhat of a repetition of the Egyptian exile. And that's why reading the Chumash is so important, because the rabbis tell us that the descent and exodus from Egypt is the source of all further exiles and redemptions. And what happened in Egypt will happen again, or did happen again in history. And that we are in one long exodus of Egypt until we finally will reach the Holy Land when Mashiach will come. Until that time, today we visited one particular era in Jewish history. And we've seen that although what was going around in the non-Jewish world, none of those peoples, the Ostrogoths and Visigoths, they survived only in having fanciful names. And yet, what does survive, what we do have, are our own people, our great works of scholarly works, and most important, of moral, ethical works, such as the Chovos HaLevavot, the duties of the heart, which inspire us even today.